claims that law must be colorblind, or that the datum of race is no longer relevant to public policy, must be seen as aspiration rather than as descriptive of reality.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Hello and welcome to the High School SCOTUS podcast, where we talk about how the decisions of the Supreme Court and the words of the Constitution play out behind the schoolhouse gate. I'm Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Saroff.
And we are back for season two of the High School SCOTUS podcast. And as a quick update on our lives outside of the world of the Supreme Court, I have been introduced to the perils of junior year, and Hannah is knee-deep in college applications.
Yay, high school senior life. But actually, don't remind me. But I guess in fairness, the doom and gloom of college applications is super uniquely relevant to our podcast topic for the next couple of months, which is affirmative action, especially in the college admissions and higher education world.
So if you have not heard, on October 31st, the Supreme Court will hear two cases, Students for Fair Admission versus University of North Carolina and Students for Fair Admission versus Presidents and Fellows of Harvard College. I personally think it's somewhat spooky and foreboding that the court will hear the cases on Halloween, but I'm hoping kids will listen to the oral argument, especially if they have the day off from school.
And as the high school senior applying to college, I also have to point out that I think it's a little funny it's October 31st because that is the day before a lot of early decision and restrictive early action and early action deadlines are. So that felt intentional. My college counselor agrees with me on this. We got a little heated about it. Anyway, not the point. Prior to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation, the court actually had combined those two cases. But in July, when Jackson announced that she would recuse herself from the Harvard case because she had sat on this board that had made the suggestions about academic programming at the school, the court split the cases so that Justice Jackson can hear the UNC case, but she still won't be hearing the Harvard one.
But we know that affirmative action is more than a legal issue. It's become a cultural, political, historical, even social flashpoint. So we're putting together a few episodes with various legal scholars who have done extensive research on all of these different facets of affirmative action, the political, the historical, the social, and of course, the legal. And so we'll take you through all of that in the next couple of months.
When taken together, we're really hoping that this little mini series will showcase the history of affirmative action that has brought us to this present moment right here and now, and also what the implications of the court's decision next spring will be, so that you all feel prepared to read the SCOTUS tea leaves, as they say, and be ready to understand what will happen.
Right, but we will also be taking listener suggestions along the way. So if there's a case you want to hear more about, a legal theory you'd like us to discuss, or a scholar or advocate we should be talking to, shoot us a DM on Twitter or email us at highschoolscotus@gmail.com. We really want to make this series something that is a resource for teachers, for students, for parents, for college counselors, so they can understand why the court is hearing this case and what the court could decide and how that will affect the admissions process.
So we're going to start today, this little mini series, with an overview of affirmative action. It's going to be boring and it's just going to be the two of us. I shouldn't say it'll be boring. It'll be fun. We're going to have fun. But it'll be just the two of us talking to each other. And we're going to overview affirmative action as it has interacted with the legal system. In the episodes to come, we'll dive way more deeply into various esoteric topics, honestly, related to affirmative action. But we really want to have some baseline knowledge on the subject first that we can share with you all, so that we're all on the same footing to understand our amazing legal scholars that we have lined up.
And I think Hannah and I will both acknowledge that we honestly didn't know a ton about affirmative action before starting our research for this episode and for the episodes to come.
I will say that I read From Brown to Bakke by J. Harvey Wilkinson III because it was in my mom's library books she had in law school. So note, this was published in 1981. So I have knowledge going up to about 1981. And oddly enough, I don't think that's quite current. So I'm excited to learn more about the present day. And so to kind of jump into just defining affirmative action is the active practice of including historically underrepresented groups based on gender, race, sexuality, or nationality, or honestly, other identity groups. Originally, affirmative action was presented as a tool to combat historical inequities, sort of a reparations-based practice to ameliorate the impact of past discrimination.
So here's the main legal and constitutional issue with affirmative action. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment declares that states may not deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. In the last 60 years, the 14th Amendment has been used as a constitutional basis to guarantee equal rights to Black people and to women. But it also poses a challenge to laws that may consider race and give underrepresented minorities an advantage in admissions.
Basically, there are these two dominant perspectives on how the 14th Amendment could be applied to affirmative action. So, like, originalist conservative thinkers will typically argue that the 14th Amendment forecloses any consideration of race at all. It calls for laws to be race blind and requires absolute total equality. Others, however, see the 14th Amendment as specifically intended to grant equality to underrepresented and historically disadvantaged minorities, and that means that affirmative action doesn't get in the way of that at all. In fact, it's working to help it, so it's totally allowed.
I think it's also important to think about that when the 14th Amendment was ratified, so all the way back right after the Civil War, people weren't thinking about affirmative action at all. Affirmative action is really just a tool to work to, as Hannah mentioned, ameliorate past discrimination and bring diversity, as we will talk about later. But now we are thinking about how, and judges are thinking about this, how can we wrestle with affirmative action in the face of amendments that demand equality?
If you think about affirmative action and the cases that follow as kind of this microcosm of all the cases we look at right now, right? A lot of the cases, I think you'll agree with me, are things that, in my opinion, I'm like, the founders would never have imagined this. Like, could the founders have envisioned climate change or cell phones or like even older technology that didn't exist when we were around? There are all kinds of things that exist now that the founders never could have imagined. And those raise really interesting legal questions. And I think while obviously the 14th Amendment was not written by the founders, it still is that same idea of things that never would have necessarily been thought of at the time or weren't intended to be addressed by a certain thing that are now being encompassed into a broader provision of the Constitution or the amendments.
Right. But eventually, affirmative action did reach the Supreme Court. So in the early 1970s, following the passage of both the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and the unraveling of decades of systemic racial discrimination during the Jim Crow era, a case arrived at the Supreme Court called Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. This was in 1977.
So it's kind of the most famous affirmative action case that the Supreme Court has decided. We're going to definitely talk about it more in future episodes, but here's what you need to know to kind of get the lay of the land for now. As often occurs in affirmative action cases, a white person, shocker of shockers, Alan Bakke was rejected twice by UC Davis Medical School, but he had a higher college GPA and higher test scores than any minority student admitted in the 2 years he was rejected. How did he collect this data?
That's interesting. I feel like you could never get that information now. They would never get that out. No way. Like, the College Board doesn't even tell us how well we did on our AP tests. Like, why would a university give away the GPA and test scores every single minority student they let in? Yeah, that's wild. So it's important to note that Davis specifically reserved 16 of the 100 spots in each year's medical class for minority students. This practice is sometimes described as a quota system that relies on a certain number of minority students to achieve this purpose of repairing discrimination or adding diversity.
So I will say, as a Jewish student, you know, who's going into the college admissions process, you hear a lot about quotas because some schools used to have really strong Jewish quotas. But I think it was interesting that this was about just minority students in general. Like, A, how did they define minority? Different questions to ponder as we move into discussion of the case later. But the resulting opinion that we got from the Supreme Court was kind of a little bit crazy. And it all hinged on Justice Lewis Powell. Four justices really firmly thought that racial quotas violated the Civil Rights Act. Powell joined them, so the official ruling was in favor of Bakke. However, four other justices thought that more generally, race could be used as a criteria for admitting students. Powell also joined that opinion.
So at this point, much of the court's reasoning for allowing race to influence admissions could be summarized in the following statement. It is because of a legacy of unequal treatment that we must now permit the institutions of this society to give consideration to race in making decisions about who will hold the positions of influence, affluence, and prestige in America. However, writing only for himself, Powell made a whole new case that had been talked about a little bit in amicus briefs and maybe in law reviews in the past, but it wasn't really the main focus. Powell argued that the diversity rationale was the only constitutionally permissible reason for affirmative action. The idea that inequality aside and past discrimination aside, diversity of race in the production of diverse leaders is always a good thing that colleges can and should work towards through a holistic admissions process that does consider race.
Oh dear, I don't want to hear it. I'm sorry, every admissions officer reading this, I love you. I don't want to hear the word holistic review ever again in my life. But for 25 years, the court did support that holistic review idea. And that was this really tenuous balance that the court struck, that race can be one of many considerations in admissions, although quotas violated both the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So your holistic review is safe from the Supreme Court in all aspects, college admissions officers around the globe. But the survival of this compromise was threatened in 2003 when the court heard Gratz v. Bollinger and Grutter v. Bollinger.
So, as Hannah mentioned, race could be one of many considerations in admissions, but quotas are allowed. I think we'll discuss this later, but it's really interesting that universities, it's so easy for them to tinker with language, right? They say that all this stuff about holistic, and again, none of us actually know what they're doing when they're making decisions about who to let into college. So it's really easy for universities to kind of obfuscate what reasoning they're actually using, how much they're using race. All this stuff is very, very hazy and unclear and murky. So that's important to keep in mind as we're doing this. A university is not always doing what they're saying.
Would any admissions officers like to come on the podcast and elaborate? That would be really fun. And we would welcome your support as a guest. But I will say, yeah, I have no idea. Like, no one knows that secret sauce. Even as someone applying, I'm like, well, I just got to be me because I don't know what they're looking for at the end of the day. There are a lot of factors, and we have no idea what those factors are, to be honest.
So, getting back to Gratz and Grutter, the two cases were very similar. Gratz concerned the University of Michigan's admission system. From 1998 to 2003, the school's Office of Admissions granted 20 points, 100 points were needed for admission, they said, we now know, to every student that is a member of an underrepresented minority. In effect, this actually granted admission to almost every minority student that applied. So we saw that those 20 points were enough to boost them over the edge for almost every student.
Grutter turned to the University of Michigan's law school method of admissions. The law school told the court that it used race as one factor in admissions for the specific purpose of achieving this diverse student body. However, the school did not require a certain number of minority students in its class or guarantee a quantitative boost in the admissions process to minority students, as the undergraduate program did.
So I think you can already see where this is heading. The court is again going to delineate based on using race as a determining factor, i.e. you get in if you are a certain race, or you are likely to get in, and race is a factor that the university is merely conscious to on some level.
A 6-3 majority found that because the undergraduate program placed so much emphasis on the minority status of an applicant, refusing to place weight on the individuality of the applicant and their application and making a decision purely based on their race was unconstitutional. Again, the distinction we drew, it's going to come up.
Right. In my mind, it seems like the court just keeps threading this very thin line. In practice, how different were these two policies? We don't know. Probably not that different, though. They both just wanted more diverse faces in their student body and more equitable opportunities for their applicants. What did the Constitution really say about the difference between an admissions program that does that really overtly and explicitly and one that does it more implicitly? We're not really sure, but this is where the court drew their line.
It's really important to recognize that there were three super duper loud dissents to the ruling in Gratz. Justices Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg each argued for different reasons that the court should allow the University of Michigan's admission system. Notably, Souter argued that an admissions policy that awards points for race is still considering other factors. It's not a strict quota or holding seat system.
Ginsburg also made a different, but interestingly persuasive argument. The Equal Protection Clause only concerns discrimination. And the admissions office wasn't trying to limit or to decrease enrollment by a particular group. That wasn't their goal. They were only trying to boost or support the enrollment of other groups. You'll see in the future that Ginsburg is going to come back. She's a really, really, really strong voice on the issue of affirmative action and advocating for race-conscious policies.
But we need to remember that we also had this second closely related case, as we've been hinting at. In Grutter, two justices flipped their vote and flipped the result. Justices O'Connor and Breyer joined Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, and Souter to uphold 5-4 the University of Michigan Law School's race-conscious admission. So how did the court differentiate between the two schools, and what line did they draw for future cases?
First of all, as the court acknowledged, the law school's admissions were more flexible. It individually examined talents, experiences, and potential for success. And while the opinion expressly forbade quotas, separate admissions tracks for different racial or ethnic groups, or automatic acceptance or rejection based on a single variable, it accepted an admissions policy that used race and ethnicity as a plus factor.
Although the court wasn't entirely sure if Powell's endorsement of the diversity rationale would bind them in the decision, they agreed with it nonetheless. In doing so, they trusted in good faith the university's judgment that diversity was, quote, essential to its educational mission. They decided to toss aside the, quote, remedying past discrimination justification for affirmative action and fully embrace the idea of diversity.
This is something we'll talk about later in actually our next episode with Professor Jonathan Macer of the University of Chicago Law School. But diversity, again, the court accepts at face value that diversity is an important goal. They don't actually ask, well, does it actually help your school? Does it make your school better? Are you producing quantitatively better results and more successful students when you add diversity? And that's interesting. They just said, okay, we'll trust the university that it has those positive results. And another thing that's really, really, really critical to note that came out of this case, Justice O'Connor declared in her opinion that 25 years from now, a rather seemingly random deadline, racial preferences would no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today, the diversity interest. That opinion was written in 2003, just over 19 years ago.
Dun, dun, dun. But either way, O'Connor's belief that you could put an expiration date or a logical endpoint on affirmative action programs is really interesting. It seems to admit that affirmative action is solving for a particular unmet need. She doesn't explicitly say past discrimination, but a lack of diversity in higher education and leadership is directly related to our country's history of racism and inequality.
So even the diversity rationale is really just reparations. So like they're doing the same thing with different words, it kind of seems like. And in her opinion, O'Connor also mentioned that race was just one form of diversity that schools take into account. They also consider geographical, socioeconomic, gender, and ethnic diversity. Now, only race, though, presents a constitutional concern because race is key to the 14th Amendment. No one cares that you take a kid from, let's say, Wyoming or Idaho over a kid from California. I'm from California, so this is a pressing concern for me because, well, that technically could be construed as discrimination against the kid from California. It's not a constitutional issue. No one is going to go complaining that I was born in the Bay Area, so my rights are violated.
As someone from Washington, I gotta say being born in California was kind of your own fault. But O'Connor, who was a swing justice, but typically more conservative leaning because she was appointed by President Ronald Reagan as our very first female Supreme Court justice, was nonetheless affirmative action saving grace for the time being.
For 25 years, as she did say. And there's one more case that's worth mentioning while we're on the topic of affirmative action's overall impact on the legal system. Fisher versus University of Texas. Now, the University of Texas, at least at the time that Fisher was heard in 2013, accepted all students in the top 10% of their Texas high schools. For other students, race was considered as a factor in admission. The case was heard in 2013, as I said, and many thought the conservative court was set to strike down Texas's admission policy.
But not so. The court compromised 7-1, the court upheld Grutter and the diversity rationale, but they did require that affirmative action policies now meet strict scrutiny,
any race-conscious admissions had to be the narrowest possible way to advance diversity interests.
So now we see the court putting a little bit more pressure on schools. They're not just saying you can do whatever you want to try to advance diversity. They're saying if you're going to use race, you need to make sure there's no other way that you can add diversity to your schools without thinking about race. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, not okay. She would also have upheld the University of Texas's system of admissions review, but she said that the court's new demanding standards weren't necessary. The University of Texas had done everything the court asked of them in Bakke and Grutter, and that was more than enough. They should have the leeway to figure out how to promote diversity, an admirable goal, at their school. Further, Ginsburg stressed that schools shouldn't try to cover up their affirmative action programs as race blind if they really weren't. Race-conscious admissions should be a good thing, and we need not deny that there are lingering effects of historic discrimination that demand affirmative action in higher education.
It honestly seems like Ginsburg kind of predicted where we are now, and moreover, where we likely will be in the near future. Universities really want to maintain a diverse student body, but understand that affirmative action programs are on death's door. Thus, they are and will continue to create programs that promote diversity, but obfuscate their goals under the guise of holistic admissions. And I gotta say, as the TA to my school civics class, we were talking about this recently in preparation for the argument because of her famous, more recent thing, but where she was talking about how getting rid of something that protects you from the impacts of racism, because you're not feeling the impacts of racism, is like throwing away your umbrella because you're not getting wet during a rainstorm, which really resonated for a lot of the Seattle-based kids, I think.
Yes, exactly. I know from Grey's Anatomy that Seattle is famous for rain, and that's basically all I know about Seattle. So let's move on. Let's talk about the two cases that the court will hear on October 31st. One thing to point out about the Harvard case, interestingly, now that we're back to it, Students for Fair Admissions actually sued the school for discriminating against Asian students in favor of white students. Specifically ignoring affirmative action's role in supporting underrepresented minorities, which seems really interesting because if you remember back to Bakke much earlier in this episode, we talked about how a white student sued because he wasn't admitted to UC Davis's medical school because 16 spots were reserved for minority students. But now we actually see that they are arguing that white students were favored over Asian students, perhaps to be more attractive to a court that might not want to say, oh, it's just white students being discriminated against.
And in fairness, this is a big part of college admissions processes, especially for Asian students, depending on what they're trying to major in and where they're trying to go. I have a friend who decided he doesn't want to apply to Stanford because he's a South Asian kid who wants to major in computer science. And my parents immediately were like, he cannot apply there. Like, those aren't good odds for him. And it's true. And he realizes that. And so it makes sense the way they're bringing this argument, but I wouldn't necessarily say that all Asian students are always discriminated against at all schools because there's race consciousness. Part of his problem is that he's trying to get into Stanford as a computer science major. So notably, before the cases in Harvard reached the justices, a district court spent 7 years. That's a really long time. On litigation surrounding the lawsuits against both Harvard and UNC, eventually ruling that both survived strict scrutiny and aligned with Grutter. So, yeah.
Honestly, imagine spending 7 years on one case. But the question before the court now leaves nothing to be confused about, and it certainly will not take the court 7 years to decide this. May institutions of higher education use race as a factor in admissions? They're just going all the way, leaving nothing on the table. Much like the Dobbs case this spring, litigants know that the newly constituted Supreme Court is likely prepared to go all the way. So why sugarcoat it and say that you're asking them not to do something that you actually want them to do? Why don't they just overrule decades of precedent? Let's go for it.
But before all of that happens and Elise's slightly, actually extremely petty comments come to fruition, we're going to be here recording episodes that cover everything you need to know about affirmative action and also a couple cool other topics. First up is our interview with Professor Jonathan Macer of the University of Chicago Law School about his research on the origins and legitimacy of the diversity rationale.
But for now, leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars, everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. We are so happy to be back for season 2, and we cannot wait to see you next time.